Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and is this a podcast I see before me? Come, let me record thee. Joining me today is Devendra Hardawar.
Out! Out, damn spot! And that's why I use pretty litter cat litter, to avoid those messes.
And also Caroline Sita, whose work can be seen at the AV Club and Fox Digital. Caroline, welcome back to The Filmcast.
Thank you for having me, and I will also say Dunsinane Hill, more like Denzel Sinane Hill.
Wow.
I went
really
with the
taking on Jeff's
choice.
Role here.
An inauspicious start to Caroline's instant on.
Listen, I needed to bring a deep cut theater reference choice to prove my credentials. That was my goal here.
So, Caroline, in the pre-show, you have acknowledged that you actually came up with a few different options for your intro statement. So
I did.
Can I hear what if that was what made it to the end? I'm so curious to hear what the rejects were.
Okay. You can see if these are better or worse. I was really panicked someone was going to take mine, which really I don't know why any of you would have. But the other things I came up with were a drum, Denzel doth come.
Wow. Okay, I like
good.
That.
Pretty good.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something Cohen this way comes. It might be in my delivery that's really throwing these off. Now, this one, maybe I'll end with this one because it's perhaps my biggest stretch. As the Eurythmics once said, weird sisters are doing it for themselves.
Wow.
Nice.
You're trying really hard.
Those are all
here,
winners.
So, yeah.
Those are all winners.
Thank you so much.
Well, welcome back to the podcast, Caroline. And I think listeners can already tell they're in good hands when it comes to the podcast. Okay, so folks may have noticed that Jeff Cannata is not on the podcast this week. I do want to acknowledge that he is not feeling well. He has a breakthrough case of COVID-19. There's a few things that I want to share with you about his situation. He had two vaccinations plus a booster. He's pretty sure he got it from his kid's school, as they've had a huge number of cases, but they didn't have any choice but to send the kids to school. So, so far, both Jeff and his kids and his wife are doing okay. And Jeff himself is feeling okay, but he's like very low energy, a lot of fatigue. He's just trying to recover as quickly as possible. And he is isolating from his family, which is very difficult. So, Jeff has been a very careful person, and you know, it still happened, and we all wish Jeff
especially
a speedy
for
recovery.
Parents of school children, like nothing, there is no choice, right, other than deciding to homeschool your kids all of a sudden, you know, and end your career. Like, it is rough out there, so
so we wish Jeff the best. Please do feel free to send Jeff some of your well wishes, and you know, message him on Twitter, or if you send any emails, I'll be sure that he gets them. But yes, we hope that Jeff has a speedy and safe recovery. He tweeted about the situation earlier. He's extremely grateful to have been double vaxxed and boosted. His situation probably much more challenging without that. So get vaccinated, folks. Stay safe out there, and be careful. And we are hoping to welcome Jeff back to the podcast as soon as he is able to come back on, which hopefully will be next week, but we'll see. So anyway, that's the situation. And we're so grateful that Caroline has agreed to fill in this week, Caroline. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great to, I mean, so far, even the last 4 minutes, you know, we've already reached new heights on the podcast.
I did wonder, you did let me know in advance that Jeff wasn't going to be here. And I was like, I wonder if I should prepare a limerick in his honor, but it felt like that might be too much of a step here.
I would never prevent someone from preparing a limerick. So
next time.
All right. Well, anyway, you can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. You can always support the podcast at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We're going to talk about some what we've been watching. We got some weekly plugs. And this week, we're going to be reviewing The Tragedy of Macbeth, which is streaming right now on Apple TV Plus. Okay, let's get to what we've been watching. Caroline Sita, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I'm in sort of a weird lull where the end of the season madness sort of just wrapped up, and I'm preparing to head into Sundance Madness in the next couple weeks. So I've sort of been in a weird lull of what I've been watching, mainly just YouTube and figure skating. But in between there, I finally watched Don't Look Up.
The two genders.
Yeah, exactly. YouTube and figure skating. Those are my two, the two wolves that wrestle inside me or whatever it is. But yeah. What I did check out recently was Don't Look Up, the Adam McKay Netflix movie, which I did not love. I know you guys did a whole episode about it, so I won't go too long on it. I mostly just wanted to say it was a very surreal movie to watch the day that I also watched the Kamala Harris interview where she told people that need COVID tests to just Google it.
Yeah.
That was like quite a mindset to be in and watching a satire about the end of the world. I didn't love the movie. It takes some bold swings in its final third that I appreciated. For the most part, it didn't quite work for me. But I actually wanted to shout out to you guys for your episode on it, because I think listening to that really helped me clarify why the movie is so divisive. I think that this was sort of a point that I think Jeff ultimately landed on with, like, it sounded like to him the movie really played as like a very funny laugh out loud comedy and sort of like a political satire second. And I was really missing the like comedic connection. So it was sort of playing
I wish it was
more,
funny. Yeah. That would help.
It was playing to me more as like, you know, very blunt satire with light comedy sprinkled throughout. But like hearing Jeff talk about how funny it was for him, I was like, oh, I completely get why, if that's how the movie plays for you, it is a successful movie. So that was like a very helpful conversation to listen to for like understanding why the responses have been so polarized.
Yeah.
I did want to clarify something. So we got a lot of positive feedback about last week's Don't Look Up episode, and I'm grateful to have it. It was a heated conversation, you know? And I think that's one of the things I enjoy about this podcast is we often have like extremely heated, intense debates. But then at the end of the day, you know, I think on some level, we all understand it's not really personal. Like we all, you know, every week we come back, we do the show again, and it feels like a reset every week. Absolutely. You know, because
go back and watch clips of Siskel and Ebert and how they would just like eviscerate each other over really dumb movies too. Like they would just get really, really pissy with each other. So
like Carnosaur, never get to that level. You know,
yeah,
a movie that I think Ebert really loved. Anyway, I think that that's one of the things I appreciate about the podcast is that we can have extremely intense, heated debates about things and still just come back and do it all over again the next week. So thanks for listening, Caroline. Thanks to all the people who shared like very, very kind feedback about that. But I do think that I'm glad we had the conversation because it really encapsulates how polarizing this movie is. Like it is a great encapsulation of the fact that like people have argued really intensely about this film and have strong reactions to it. And I don't think like our reactions were atypical in any way. So it sounds like you didn't enjoy it that much, but maybe still found some value in it, Caroline?
Yeah, I would say I didn't have a terrible time watching it. Like, it wasn't a movie that, like, made me angry while I was watching it. It more just didn't quite work for me.
All right. Well, I'm glad you weren't seething with rage while you were watching Don't Look Up, which is streaming right now on Netflix. Caroline, what else have you been watching this week?
Yeah, so I feel like you guys usually highlight sort of newer things on here, but one movie I watched and loved recently is Roman Holiday, the 1950s rom-com with Audrey Hepburn. you know, if you want a really current, up-to-the-moment plug, there's one for you.
Yeah, you've got the thumb on the pulse of culture
right now. Exactly. I really like to have the timely references here. I write a column about romantic comedy, so I'm frequently thinking about the romantic comedy genre. And I just feel like Roman Holiday is really one of the best. Like, if you want sort of sweet, poignant, thoughtful escapism with beautiful vistas of Rome and, like, lovely performances from Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn, like, if you just kind of want to escape the world a little bit, I would so highly recommend seeking out Roman Holiday. It just holds up so well. And has one of my favorite rom-com endings of all time. I just think it's such a lovely film.
Couple questions, Caroline. Mm-hmm. First of all, where can people find this column?
It's for the AV Club, and then it's called When Romance Met Comedy.
And how did you watch Roman Holiday?
I believe that I rented it.
Got it. So it's available on VOD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what do you think makes Roman Holiday one of the best romantic comedies of all time? Like, what makes something a superlative romantic comedy, in your opinion?
I think that Roman Holiday is incredibly simple. It is almost like a silent film at times. It's the story of this princess, the sort of European princess who decides she just wants a normal day out and so poses as a regular person and meets up with this journalist played by Gregory Peck who secretly knows she's the princess and is trying to sort of get gossip on her and they sort of have a day almost like Aladdin style, like a day out with the the young humble guy and the hidden princess. And I think it's just an incredibly simple movie that almost functions like a silent film. Like so much of the character arc is just coming across on the actors' faces. And I think the simplicity lets it get to very like poignant places. And it's not a movie that's like, we have this big, massive blowout and then somebody runs to the airport and then it's, you know, hitting all these like annoying cliches of the rom-com. I would say it's like elevating the good sort of tropes of the rom-com. And I just think Audrey Hepburn is such a phenomenal actress and sometimes doesn't get credit for that because she's held up as this like fashion icon or this sort of just celebrity figure. But I actually think she's just an incredible performer and so much of the movie just hinges on what she's doing with her face just in silent reaction shots. And it's so compelling to watch.
Awesome. Well, Roman Holiday is available for rent right now. If you are into great romantic comedies, thanks for that recommendation. What else have you watching, Caroline?
So another one that I loved and that I have a little bit of a, I didn't realize this until this morning, but when I was on the podcast last for West Side Story, sort of the day before I came on the podcast, I went to a press screening of The Matrix Resurrections. Then last night, I was looking for something to watch, and I put on The Matrix Resurrections. So apparently my new tradition is that before I come on the Filmcast podcast, I just have to watch The Matrix Resurrections.
That's a pretty good tradition. Yeah.
Nice. I would be happy to keep it up because my hot take is that The Matrix Resurrections is maybe a perfect film. Maybe.
this was my number one last year.
I was so pleased to hear that choice. Excellent choice. I really loved this movie on a first watch. And on a second watch, I think it might be my favorite of the Matrix films.
What? Even beating Matrix 1, you say?
I can't say it is objectively better than Matrix 1. Like, objectively, the first Matrix is the best, but I think Resurrections might be my favorite.
It's like, so tell us why this movie is your favorite. What makes it your favorite?
Well, this kind of ties into the Roman Holiday thing, where I think that Resurrections is first and foremost a romance, which is A, just such a fun and unexpected choice for a sci-fi film that I think really fits with like Lana Wachowski's sort of like Sense8 ethos, which I love. And I think it's a great use of Keanu Reeves. It's like, instead of Keanu Reeves, John Wick action star, what if we go with like Keanu Reeves, something's got to give, rom-com star, and that's the character he's playing now.
Wow. Yeah. The Lake House Keanu Reeves. Yeah,
exactly.
As Neo. Yeah.
And I think that it's just such a good use of Keanu Reeves' like sweet, soft boy energy where he's just like, my role in life shouldn't be to be a superhero. It should be to be the supportive partner or like, you know, the have this amazing supportive crush on this incredible woman. And I just exist to support her. And I think that's such like a fun dynamic for this movie to have. It's so like such a playful movie. And I think it's also very like smart and thoughtful. And yes, there's flaws, but like, I don't care. I don't care that the action isn't that good because it gave me a beautiful romance with Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss. And that's really all I want.
Yeah. I really liked your Twitter thread, by the way. So everybody should
go check that out
because you were calling out things scene by scene. And you reminded me that I was on board with this movie from the moment Bugs and Morpheus hugged, like at the very beginning. Where it's just like the intro to that movie is just so wild, right? Because you're recreating the Trinity scene from the first Matrix, then you're like seeing it from another angle, then you see a new agent, and like it's all this stuff happens, and then they hug. And then at that point, I'm like, wow, this movie is just, it is doing something completely different. It is very much the Matrix through the eyes of Sense8 series, which is great, and everybody should watch it. There are things in Sense8 that I don't think I've seen in any other show, including like, you know, massive sci-fi orgies. It's great. They really brought that back from Reloaded. So check out Sense8, definitely. And glad you like this a lot, Caroline.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt that like half the cast, more than half the cast of Sense8 pops up in Matrix Resurrections.
It's great.
And every
it's
time
great.
They did, it felt like a little gift to me. So that also maybe helped with my enjoyment of Resurrections.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you liked it. You know, obviously it wasn't my thing, but I know it was definitely Devendra's thing and many, many other film critics' thing. So Matrix Resurrections, still available on HBO Max, right, for the next
week or so. Yes, it leaves Friday as we're recording, the 21st, I believe.
Yeah, so if you want to get in your Matrix Resurrections rewatches, make sure to do that soon, or sooner rather than later. But yeah, that's the Matrix Resurrections. It's what else Caroline has been watching this week. All right, I'll mention a few things I've been watching. I want to start by talking about Cheer Season 2. This is the new season of the Cheer docuseries that's on Netflix. It's the first season was directed by Greg Whiteley. He has a co-director on for this season. Have any of you watched Cheer at all by any chance?
No. Talk about it? I know you guys loved it, but sometimes there are these things that everybody starts loving on Twitter, and I'm like, I'll just have to wait on that just a bit. So yeah, mm-hmm. Now season two is here. I'll catch up eventually.
Caroline, have you seen Cheer season?
No, I haven't. I've like heard people describe elements of it, but I haven't watched it.
This is like, people will say I am overstating this, you know, but this is one of the most sort of extraordinary docuseries I have ever watched. Jeff Cannata and I talked at length about Cheer season one and how like excellent and beautiful it was. And somehow Cheer season two like reaches even higher emotional heights, in my opinion. So if you don't know anything about Cheer, the series, and by the way, it's actually not that often. I was talking with my wife about this. It's actually not very often that there are like long running docuseries, right? That mm-hmm. like there's a lot of reality television, you know, but there's not that many docuseries that are like documentaries that follow people's lives throughout like the course of many things, many events, and over the course of many years. So that alone kind of makes Cheer pretty special. But Cheer, for those who don't know, is about the season one was about the cheerleading team in the small town of Corsicana, Texas, at Navarro Community College. And season one follows that team for basically an entire season as they prepare to compete at nationals or finals or whatever it's called. And the overall sort of objective of season one, from my perspective, was to give you an appreciation of the work and athleticism that goes into the sport that many people dismiss as kind of superfluous or not serious or whatever. Once you watch Cheer season one, you will not think that it is not one of the highest feats of athleticism that is possible. And so that was Cheer season one, and it was already extraordinary. And so I'm thinking like, okay, that was a great season. It's beautiful. Like the way that the cheerleading practices and performances are filmed, like it just gives you so much appreciation for this as an art form. And then you really care about these people's lives, because many of these people got into cheerleading because their lives like weren't going well. Like they come from broken homes, or they come from like really challenging home lives, and cheerleading was a way to like center them and give them a kind of grounding and routine that helped them to organize their lives. So you kind of get a real appreciation of like what this sport does for them. And also the head coach, Monica Aldama, and the kind of maternal figure that she is in many of these people's lives. So that's Cheer season one. Cheer season one was basically a phenomenon. I mean, it was one of those shows that went, you know, international, and you know, tens of millions of people watched it, and everyone who was prominently featured in Cheer season one basically got famous. You know, they became influencers pretty much. Some of them made millions of dollars off of ad deals as a result of like being featured in Cheer season one. They were interviewed on like Ellen and met like many of their heroes, met like Joe Biden and like all these, you know, like it. Cheer season one had like an explosive impact on like many of these people's lives. So Cheer season two basically deals with the fallout of that. Like, what is it like to be not anyone that anyone knows about, right? To never have any expectation that you're going to be famous. And then the next day, everyone knows who you are. Like everyone in your city knows who you are. Hundreds of thousands of people like scrutinize your every move in social media. Like, what is that like? And also, by the way, you need to keep living your life and competing in this competition. And it is totally fascinating. And I think just like really interesting the way the show explores fame and also just like, you know, it's ultimately a documentary about a competition, and the way that it makes the competition, it explains everyone's backstory. It makes you really root for all the teams that are in the show and like want them to succeed. So I watched the entirety of Cheer Season 2, which is 9 50-minute episodes in one day, which I've never done.
That's a bit much. Yeah.
But that's how good it is. That's how extraordinary it is. Now, I know, like, I'm really into documentaries, you know, and so, like, this might not be for everyone, but in terms of a docuseries that goes deep into both a specific niche, like in this case, cheerleading, and the people behind that niche, and has lots of emotional, powerful interviews, and also just beautiful cinematography of the sport itself, I don't think you can do better than Cheer Season 2. So I recommend it in the strongest terms possible. If you haven't seen Cheer Season 1, go back, watch Cheer Season 1, then watch Season 2. You cannot... This is not a show where you can start with season 2. You know, you got to start with season 1.
Does it reckon with the guy that everybody loved who turned out to be a child predator?
It does.
Okay.
It does. So
I remember that.
For those who don't know, there was a character that was much beloved in season 1 who became super famous. Everyone loved this guy. And then he was prosecuted for sex crimes in the year after the show came out. And I will just say that the way the show handles it is incredibly sensitive and powerful, and it's one of the most extraordinary hours of television I've ever seen. So yes, it does handle it, and I can't recommend it enough. You know, it's just I was so moved by it, and I just would say go watch it if you haven't yet. So that's Cheer. Cheer Season 2 is available right now on Netflix. Season 1 is also available on Netflix, and it's one of my favorite things ever. So that's one of the things I've been watching this week. It's time to thank our sponsor this week, Headspace. Do you ever feel like your mind doesn't have an off switch, or that tension is constantly traveling through your body, or do you feel tired no matter how much you sleep? That's just a few of the many ways stress, anxiety, and sleeplessness can harm your mind and body. I know I feel many of those emotions, sometimes even during the podcast. Anyway, this year, why not make small changes to your daily routine that have a big influence on your mental health and well-being? Start your year with Headspace. We all say we're doing fine when we don't really mean it. Fine isn't really an emotion, is it? How many times have you told yourself you're fine when all you've really been feeling are negative emotions like anger or sadness or nerves? Headspace has been scientifically shown to help you manage your feelings and your mental health. In fact, a recent study showed in just 2 weeks, Headspace can reduce one's stress by 14%. Whether you want to relieve stress and anxiety, sleep better, or improve your focus, Headspace is your everyday dose of mindfulness for real life. Now, I want to tell you about my personal experience with Headspace, and that is I have been a huge fan of their sleep features. In fact, often I use some of their Sleepcast to fall asleep. You know, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, I can't get back to sleep. I'll turn on my Headspace app, use their Sleepcast to fall asleep. It has been a huge help to me. But that's just one of many features that Headspace offers. Be sure to check it out yourself. However you're feeling, try Headspace at headspace.com/filmcast and get 1 month free of their entire mindfulness library. This is the best Headspace offer available. So go to headspace.com/filmcast today. That's headspace.com/filmcast. Thanks to Headspace for sponsoring this podcast. All right. I want to talk about a couple other things I've been watching this week. I had a chance to talk about or to watch the entirety of Yellow Jackets season 1 this week as well.
Yeah.
And season 1 finale aired this week. We're not going to spoil the season 1 finale. But I will say that at the end of the day, so for those who don't know, Yellow Jackets is about this soccer team, this team of teenage girl soccer players that basically was on a flight to nationals, and the flight crash landed, and some of them survived, and then you follow the show follows both the story of what happens as a result of the plane crash, and also like what happens to these people's lives like decades later. And for me, Yellow Jackets is half of an amazing show. The half that features the plane crash with the kids and what's going on, it is exceptionally well done. It is amazing performances. I love the dynamics. It really captures the brutality of not only wilderness survival, but just being in high school, which is its own kind of survival, right? Like, it's hard to compete with cliques and people being popular and being an outcast and so on. And I think Yellow Jackets totally nails all that really, really well. The adult stuff I find to be kind of second-rate Coen Brothers, and I find it to be very implausible and not very interesting and kind of boring and bad.
How dare you?
And I got to the end of the show, and I didn't hate it, but I don't know if I'm going to watch season two. That said, like, that's kind of my impression, is like, I got to the end and I'm like, yeah, like, could I do season two?
That's insane to me that you'd watch the majesty of the show and just like, I get it, because I also know some people don't like the teen section. Because I've heard says some people just don't want to deal with like stuff that could be possibly around witchcraft or some weird like mystery thing, you know, yeah. Like they're not.
There
into that.
There's heavy hints that something supernatural may be taking place in the show. And
this show, I think of all the like Lost clones, is perhaps the best at like combining the things that made Lost so good. But I think I get what you're saying, Dave, but the adult cast, which includes people we love. I think that's the best reason to watch it. So you've got Melanie Lynskey, you know, you've got Christina Ricci, you've got Juliette Lewis, and these are all people I grew up watching, you know, in the 90s.
Yeah,
I remember their 90s personas. So I get that kick out of watching them in the adult storylines. I agree. It is, I wouldn't say second rate Coen Brothers, but you know,
I think it's
as compelling as
I'm not going to explain, I'm not going to give away any plot details, but some of it just feels extremely silly and implausible to me, like all the adult stuff. Every time I was with the adult stuff, I was like, where's Poochie? Like, why can't we see more of Poochie?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, like, why can't we go back to the older plot line with the
I also see firmly what's happening here, because it's a show that kind of manages a couple different tones at the same time. And I know how much you want like tonal consistency. Like, you just want the one thing.
It's,
you know?
I mean, it's fair. But you know, I did get a bunch of flack for tweeting what I just said. I also got a lot of tweets of support. I think some people feel the same way. So
I mean, that's fine. That's totally fine.
It sounds like you greatly enjoyed the show.
I love the show. Yes. I think it's great. Yeah. I'd say it has issues on both the flashback, because the girls being trapped, basically being stuck in the middle of the woods, is all happening in the 90s. The modern day stuff is basically today of the older cast. And I think both sides like have potential issues. Like there are mysteries they haven't fully, you know, solved yet. They're like clearly like going to dangle us along for several seasons. But what works is the chemistry of the cast, like the way, especially like the way the core adult women, like when they get together, pretty much by the end, like whenever they're working together, I think it's like really fascinating. So I am less about plot structure and whatnot. If it's working on a character level and if it's like keeping me hooked and interested as a viewer, like I will forgive a lot of plot issues for that. And then in the finale, we get, I think one of the best TV, like team strut sequences I've ever seen set to come out and play by the Offspring. And I was just like, I wanted to cheer when that happened. Like there is some of the best 90s music drops I've ever heard.
It is like
on
the soundtrack, the needle drops are really incredible in the show. So no doubt about that. I mean, episode 9, I would argue, is a tour de force. I'm not even going to say what happens in it, but I'm just going to say, like, it is a film unto itself, what happens in episode 9, and really, really well done. Like, a very terrifying episode. And so there are definitely some real highlights. But
yeah,
Devendra, I mean, you have to share my fear, which is that Showtime is going to drag this thing out 4 years longer than it should go.
I think right? I think from the interviews I've read so far, it sounds like the showrunners have like a 4 or 5 season plan. And right now it is like the most popular show Showtime has ever had, right? I subscribe
to
Showtime.
Billions, I think. It's, 5 million viewers. It's really astonishing. It's a huge hit.
I don't know like how much they'll drag it out. Like right now, Showtime has revived Dexter, a show that existed for far, far too long and apparently is back. So who knows what will happen with Yellow Jackets? I hope it doesn't kind of get there. But I'm less about, you know, how bad things could be in the future. This is a life perspective thing, right? Like, this is the difference between me and you, Dave, right? Like, I will watch Lost from the beginning and like really get into the mystery. And like, you know, if it starts to get bad, I bounce. I leave. And maybe I'll check back in to see if like my characters, the people I like, get better. But it is not like a wasted time for me if something doesn't end well. Unless it like retroactively makes everything worse, right? So there are certain situations, think of like How I Met Your Mother and stuff, like how that ended, and Game of Thrones, of course. So, you know, I'm ready for this journey. I love these characters. I'm really intrigued to see like where they take the big mysteries, because this is a series that also, it goes hard, you know? It is
The thing. That's one of the things I admire about the show is it is a deeply upsetting show. And what
there's
I like
cannibalism, the
content
being
in the show, like limb amputation, mutilation, child death. Like it has everything that might possibly upset you in it. And you got to admire the show that's willing to go there. You know, like not very many shows are willing to do all that these days. And so, there's a lot to admire here. I just didn't love it as much as everyone else. And I'm sad because, you know, I wanted to. I immersed myself deeply in the world of Yellow Jackets.
I'm glad you checked it out, because I do remember like when Lost started, I tried to like get a lot of people into it, and it became a phenomenon. But even then, like, it was hard to convince people to watch, you know, the people being stuck on an island show, because it sounded like Gilligan's Island or something with a bit of sci-fi. So I think the exciting part of a show like Yellow Jackets is being there kind of as it's building up. You know, like seeing the fan theories, seeing like people get amped for this, being there along the discovery process, I think is really exciting. So definitely check it out, folks.
I sort of missed the boat on Yellow Jackets, and it was at some point I was like, okay, I'll just catch up on this later.
Yeah.
But it has been so fun to just watch my Twitter timeline and try to figure out what this show is just based on like the memes and the reactions. And at first I was like, oh, okay, this is just like a bunch of beloved character actresses together. And then like someone will tweet about cannibalism and I'm like, what? And then you guys are like,
this is a show that like starts, and it starts with cannibalism. Like this is, this is
first episode one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not incredible. Even episode one. Episode one, scene one, basically.
Scene one. Yeah.
So, yeah. There's definitely some highlights, and yeah, it sounds like you and I kind of enjoyed kind of different things about it. But you are right. Devendra is right that like it does have these amazing actresses that you know we all grew up with. Some of us grew up with, and it's like it is a delight to see them together.
Basically,
you know, like
three of my '90s crushes are here in this show, crushing it. And I am fully on board. So I may be a little biased too. So yeah.
Fair enough. But that's Yellow Jackets season one. Again, no regrets for me from watching it, but I don't think I'm going to continue to season two. So it's streaming right now on Showtime. All episodes are available now. You can stream them all. You can binge it if you want. That's Yellow Jackets. Finally, Search Party season five.
Yes.
I finished Search Party season five this weekend. You know, what a journey. I mean, I think season five is actually one of the weaker seasons out of the show. Like, but
I kind of agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'll say what I said when we talked about this a week or two ago, which is that I remain impressed by the fact that this is a show that's willing to try radically different things every season. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And in terms of like sheer enjoyment and laughs, I would say season five was the one that like I probably got the least out of. Some of the episodes were like kind of rough, in my opinion, and weren't that fun. But I like where the show ended up going. It is very surprising, and I kind of enjoyed the overall arc and even the message. But yeah, I do think this is kind of one of the weaker seasons of Search Party of the series. Caroline, it sounds like you finished it as well. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I think it's a season that starts strong and ends strong and gets a little lost in the middle.
Sure.
I think it leans towards this a broadness of what it's making fun of that I think like where the show thrives is in its like specificity. Like sometimes it will just make fun of these tiny self-centered interactions. You know, millennial interactions or just like, you know, contemporary societal interactions that are so funny. But I think that season five in the middle, it does this whole like subplot with all these sort of like Instagram influencers and sort of this tech billionaire that felt like broad in a way. I think that the show is not the show at its best.
Yeah. Devendra, how far are you into?
I finished it.
Oh, nice.
I agree that it starts and ends very strong. And yeah, there's a bit of a lag in the middle, but I was fully on board with all of it, right? That tech billionaire is played by Jeff Goldblum. You know, John Waters shows up as the head of like this most one of the most insane, like this season goes like full Brazil or full like Terry Gilliam, like insane sci-fi concepts at certain times. So like,
yeah,
they just introduce things and just expect you to like accept it, right? Like you can buy a designer kid basically through like a mail order service or something, like stuff like that. And I was fully on board with like all the wild swings, because it felt like we knew this was the final season, and this is a show that has always taken very wild swings, and now they're just like, whatever, man, we're not responsible for the, you know, to explain all this, just like we have what, 10 episodes, so just like deal with whatever we're throwing at you. And I was fully on board for the ride. And I think we need to have a spoiler discussion of this at some point, because I do think like the idea of like where basically what millennials do in this show and what they're responsible for, I think is deeply hilarious. And yeah, definitely ties into like what season one was doing as well. And man, like how far things have come from the simple days of, you know, Dori Seif just looking for a lost girl to where things go. I love it so much just for all that. And it is still funny, like the interactions between the characters, even as things get crazier and crazier, I think are deeply grounded in like the same sort of like conflicts and like pettiness and millennial like speak as the first season. So season one, I started rewatching that like after I moved out of New York, and it really made me miss and not miss certain aspects of like being in New York and around a lot of people like this. But it is deeply funny to me, like how much it just like really, really leans in on the fact that certain millennials can be goddamn exhausting. So I found it all hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree that I think it actually ends very strong. So I have no regrets about this journey. I think it's been a wild ride, and I do think that it's worth checking out the entire show. Search Party seasons 1-5 streaming right now on HBO Max. And maybe we'll do an After Dark next week about it.
We kind of have to, because I think of like certain scenes from this season of just like one thing that basically turns into like somebody entering It Chapter 2, which I think is
so good.
Incredible. So good.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Search Party season 5, that's what I've been watching this week. Devendra, hit us up with a few things you've been watching.
Yeah, a couple of things. I got a lot of things, actually, so I'll move pretty quickly. But I got to see Encanto, the latest Disney animation film about... how to explain this movie? It's about a Colombian girl who lives in a magic house, and everybody in her family has magical powers because of the house, and the house is also, like, sentient. It is wild. It is really wild, really fun. It is also deeply disturbing. And despite being like a very, very like, oh, this is going to be a fun family film, I think it is entirely about how deeply screwed up this family is and the lingering impacts of family trauma can have on people. This show goes places, like, or this movie goes places. It begins with like basically somebody's family getting wiped out because of, I think, drug related violence or something. Like, they don't really say it, but basically somebody's entire family, or her husband and the rest of her family.
I took it as more of like a civil unrest kind of deal, but yeah.
It's
really a dark way to kind of introduce that idea, and without any specificity either.
Yeah. It's set in Colombia, so it's kind of like alluding to a lot of the troubles Colombia has had. I think it also, like, it is a movie deeply about like the mean grandma trope. And I find like it does some really interesting work around that without, I'm not going to spoil too much, but
is it, by the way, is it in Colombia? I know it is. Okay. I didn't know if it was explicitly said Colombia in there, but anyway. Okay.
I don't know if like the movie declares it, but
I believe they sing it. I feel like I'm sort of remembering from the trailer. Yeah. Somebody going like Colombia.
I know that many of them are Colombia, you know, so I'm not doubting that that's what it is, but I just don't recall. I wonder if it was kind of like, more like Raya and the Last Dragon situation, where it's not like an amalgamation.
The mountainous village area they're in is like very, very much Colombia. But also want to say, like, this is a movie that also features songs written, original songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I do feel like he's reached a point in culture where people are just like done with him, or at least like Twitter people, right? Especially when like
Gen Z. Gen Z specifically.
Gen Z is done with him, but also like I think a lot of like discourse people on Twitter are just like sick of him, especially the way like the Democrats deployed him for like to support voting rights. A lot of it is very cringe. I agree. But the songs in this movie are freaking fantastic. And I've seen this movie 5 or 6 times at this point because my daughter is really digs it. Like she has a lot of fun with it. I think the songs are fantastic. But I think what's also really interesting is that it is the villain of this movie is not who you would expect, basically. Like I think the main antagonist or the person that's kind of like making everything kind of bad for the family. And I think confronting it is really interesting, and it does kind of sugarcoat things by the end because it's a Disney movie, but it is interesting the way it explores it. And I think it's, you know, for anybody who's ever encountered a mean grandma, especially, you know, in cultures outside of America, it does a really interesting job of showing like why they can be the way they are and also, you know, how they impact the rest of the family. Like a lot of this stuff trickles down. So I found that all really fascinating.
I've watched the movie. I enjoyed it as well, Caroline. It sounds like you were a fan too. Yeah,
I did. Yeah. I would say for me, it is not quite as high as Moana and my beloved Tangled, which is like one of my favorite animated movies of all time. But I would put it above the Frozen films, which I'm not a huge fan of in this sort. And I would put it above Raya too. I wasn't a huge fan of Raya and the Last Dragon. I do want to add to everything you're saying, Devinder, that Encanto is also like beautiful to look at.
So good.
Like, the animation is stunning. They do a lot of the same use of light, like magic light, as Tangled does. I think one of the directors or the co-directors also worked on Tangled. And it's just like this beautiful imagery and the way they do the sort of magic house where sort of it's like personified. It's more like the floorboard will sort of like kick up the main character's shoes to like so she can slip into them as she's walking around. Like it's so playful and like original, and all the animation I thought was gorgeous.
Basically, the way they anthropomorphize the house is like really effective and creative.
It's really good. It's what I mean. It goes back to like what Mickey Mouse days with Disney, but I think it looks and works really well here too.
So that's Encanto. It's streaming right now on Disney Plus. All three of us enjoyed it. Devinder, what else have you been watching?
I also finished Station 11. Guys, this is a really good season of TV, right? Like, I am just like going from watching, like, we finished at Succession and then Station 11 took its spot. And it has ended up becoming like one of my favorite shows, I think, ever. It is up there with The Leftovers for me. This is a show, you know, it is set in a post-pandemic world. The first episode starts with like a flu that kills off like what 95% of the world's population or like some very large amount. So it is a very triggering show to watch right now. But man, do they do some really interesting things here. So I was like full on bawling by the final few episodes of the show. And I think the finale is just like one of the most beautiful things I've seen on TV in a very long time. It doesn't wrap everything up completely. Like I think it introduces certain plot lines that never really get fleshed out. And because this is technically a miniseries and I think they covered everything that was in the novel, like we probably won't like see more of this unless, you know, the showrunner like has an idea or something. I really love this, but maybe you have to have like a certain sensibility to like find hope in the hopelessness or hope in society somehow trying to rebuild itself after a society wiping event. I find a certain comfort from it. I think it's a story that's really well told, and the way it like focuses on different characters and moves back and forth in time, I thought was really, really compelling. So just tremendous TV. Like there's just some incredible stuff in Station 11. I am fully prepared to like go read the book because I know the show is very different, but I really kind of want to see, you know, the ways this author was thinking of this world. So yeah, loved it. I'd highly recommend it to everybody, especially if you liked The Leftovers.
That's Station 11 is streaming right now on HBO Max. What else have you been watching, Devendra?
Insecure also ended, also on HBO. You know, HBO has a lot of good TV. Like, they're just, like, killing it. But this is the Issa Rae show about a group of, like, black friends in L.A. It ran for, I believe, 5 seasons at this point. Yeah, this is the 5th season. I thought it was a really beautiful ending for the show because it kind of, like, I'm not going to spoil anything here, but it kind of gives you a glimpse into the future of like where characters that we've loved for several seasons, where they go, how their lives end up. And maybe it's a little neat for some people, but I really dig the show. I think it's like truly hilarious. And like everybody in the show is just is doing some amazing work here. So I'd highly recommend Insecure. And at least I can say like they didn't like screw up the ending again, like How I Met Your Mother. So I'm very glad like everything ended very well here.
I like this scale of criticism. Is it better or worse than How I Met Your Mother?
It's the How I Met Your Mother scale.
Is it How I Met Your Mother? I just read Siddhant Adlaka just wrote something for Polygon, I believe. But about like the ending of How I Met Your Mother. So that show is on my mind right now. But I was also reminded like, hey, man, that show was good in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like so good. And then, wow, did they screw it up? So that is kind of like my personal scale. You know, if I continue to care about you for your entire run, and if you give me a good finale and a good final season, I will sing your praises for sure.
All right, Devendra, what else have you been watching?
Also, shouting out The Righteous Gemstones, a show which I have in the past described as Succession in the South, because it very much is the template of Succession. You know, it is about a rich family running like a mega church. John Goodman is the patriarch. He's the head of it. And his children include Danny McBride, Adam Devine, or is it Devine? It's like it is this like big institution they've built. They are very rich. The children are like vying for control and to see like who will eventually take over. So many of the dynamics of Succession are here, but it is also a show that is it's a show featuring Danny McBride. It's a show co-created by Jody Hill, who did a lot of like, you know, all the Danny McBride shows like Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals and stuff. So it is deeply weird and deeply wild and like off kilter. So it is just kind of hilarious where things go on this. Last season, last season featured like Walton Goggins, you know, in this going against Danny McBride in like full on comedy form. Eric Andre is in this season. I think it is a weird show. It is a wild show. It may not be for everybody, but I think the tone of it is absolutely hilarious and something I really click with. So I'd highly recommend The Righteous Gemstones. Season 2 just started, and it's a lot of fun, especially if you want to see like a show that's not set in New York or LA or like the typical places, right? It's set in the South and it kind of like spends a lot of time here. And like a lot of shows, I don't think it is not making fun of people down here, which is something I live outside of Atlanta now. So it's like, I recognize when people start to like just dismiss the South and Southern culture and whatnot. This show is reckoning with the world of megachurches and like how gross it can be at times, but also humanizing a lot of these folks too. So I think it's worth watching.
All right. That's The Righteous Gemstones just entering season 2. And that's also on HBO Max. Devendra, last thing you've been watching this week?
Last thing. I've been watching so many things. I did also want to shout out on HBO, Sort Of. The show is called Sort Of. It's by
Terrible name.
It's not a great name because it's really hard to like introduce it. But it stars and is created by Bilal Beg, who is a gender fluid 20-something. He's kind of like trying to figure out his like the way they want to live, basically, right? It's like a very 20-something show because it's about them trying to find their direction in life, trying to like figure out like how they'll talk to their families about their gender identity, but also like, you know, just kind of what they want to do. I think it's really funny, it's really sweet, and it can also like veer into being like very, very like dramatic at times too. But I think it's really, really worth watching. It's also set in Toronto. So you get like a city, like a street level view of like what that city could be like. And it also covers like a lot of like, you know, really cool genderqueer subcultures in Toronto as well. So I think it's worth watching. It's on HBO Max.
All right. That's what Devendra has been watching this week. And that's what we've all been watching this week. Let's get to some weekly plugs. All right, Weekly Plugs, the part of the show where we talk about other stuff that we've been creating. Caroline, what's a specific weekly plug you have?
Yeah, well, I will just shout out my podcast, which is called Roll Calling. That's R-O-L-E. I do it with my friend Ned Baker, who is a filmmaker and actor. And the premise is that we take an actor we love and we sort of curate a little five film miniseries that we think sort of like sums up the highlights of their career or just interesting aspects of their career. And we've done people like Christian Bale and Emily Blunt and Jamie Lee Curtis and James Dean and Jeffrey Wright. But the specific episode I will point your listeners to, since I'm assuming you have a bunch of cool, interesting, film-loving listeners, is we did an episode on Dev Patel in The Green Knight, which I think was really fun, and sort of doing our whole series on Dev Patel and where he started with Slumdog and then where he has gone since then was just like a really cool arc to trace. And I think Green Knight was a really cool and interesting one to sort of end that series on and dig into. So yeah, the podcast is called Roll Calling. That's Roll, R-O-L-E. And you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Very cool. I just watched The Green Knight again recently on 4K Blu-ray. I think it might have melted my eyeball.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful...
On your OLED movie. And everything.
Oh, yeah. It's an incredible viewing experience on a nice TV in 4K. So we strongly recommend. Also, by the way, you know where physical media really shines is with movies that have a lot of darkness in them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, because I think a lot of modern streaming devices, like, can't really handle darkness compression super well and ends up being really smudgy and not looking that good. And this is a moment where, like, having a Blu-ray or 4K Blu-ray really makes a big difference, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, Green Knight, check out Caroline Sita's podcast Roll Calling about it. I just want to give a plug for my personal Patreon page at patreon.com/DaveChen, where I basically do full reviews of stuff like immediately after it's out. I had reactions of like Matrix Resurrections and Yellow Jackets and Station 11 and stuff like right after they came out. Would recommend you check out the podcast here over at patreon.com/DaveChen if you want my unprocessed, raw, and not particularly articulate reactions to some of the stuff that's happening. Again, that's my personal Patreon page. Devendra, your weekly plug.
I just wanted to shout out the Gadget podcast in general. Check it out. I was actually off for the last week, so we didn't have a new episode. A bunch of people took time off after CES, but we are planning to do some really cool stuff. We've got episodes planned talking about the James Webb Telescope. We're going to be diving into like some of the newest laptops and stuff coming out, and it's going to be a really exciting year for tech. So, you know, follow us along. You can find the Engadget podcast everywhere you find podcasts.
All right. And also a weekly plug for some of the podcast stuff. If you want to support the show, you can always go to patreon.com/filmpodcast and sign up for ad-free episodes and or exclusive After Darks. Of course, if you want to support us but don't want to pay money, it's very easy to do that. All you got to do is go to Apple Podcasts, leave a review for us or a star rating. It really does make a difference. Also, Spotify has just launched podcast ratings. So if you're on Spotify listening there, just spend a few seconds, leave a star rating for the Filmcast podcast. We'd really appreciate it. Finally, if you want to use #/tag on Twitter, that's how you can recommend stuff for us to watch in the weeks to come. A lot of recommendations have come that way and have been used as part of the show. So we really appreciate all the people who recommend things, all the people who donate, all the people who rate us on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify, and all the people who just listen and don't do any of that. We still appreciate you anyway. Okay, let's get to our review of The Tragedy of Macbeth.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes.
My husband. King that shall be.
If we should fail.
We fail. Didst thou not hear noise?
Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more.
And a bold one. Dare look upon that which might appall the devil.
That was from the trailer for The Tragedy of Macbeth, the newest film by director Joel Cohen. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. A Scottish lord becomes convinced by a trio of witches that he will become the next king of Scotland, and his ambitious wife supports him in his plans of seizing power. Now,
that's so sweet. You know, it sounds so like
she may have girl bossed a little bit too hard, you know, but yes. The Tragedy of Macbeth, it's based off of a play by William Shakespeare that's around 500 years old. And as a result, I think we're going to just say there's going to be no spoiler section in this episode. You should just assume there's going to be spoilers for the play right up front. Now, there are things I would argue actually are kind of spoilers.
Sure.
In the sense there are decisions that Joel Coen makes that make this different than both the original play and also other renditions of it. So you should assume we are going to spoil all those things from the beginning of this review. But I want us to be able to speak freely about the Tragedy of Macbeth because it's weird to talk about some things and not others. And it sounds ridiculous. It sounds ridiculous when we're trying to avoid spoilers for something like Macbeth. So all that said, Caroline Sita, I'm very curious. What did you think of Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth?
Yeah, I really dug this movie. The word I would use to describe it is groovy. Wow. I don't know why that's what I landed on.
You're really Austin Powering this. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm channeling Austin Powers. It's black and white. Gorgeous cinematography, gorgeous set design, sort of this really interesting choice to blend something that feels cinematic with something that feels incredibly theatrical in a way that I'm not sure I've quite seen done before. It's only an hour and 46 minutes long, which I cannot say enough how joyous that is to me.
Well, and just some context for that, which is just that, like, for 2021, so many movies have been 2.5 hours long.
So long. Yeah,
and, you know, I don't care. Long movies. I don't care. It's just, there's been so many of them. There's just been so many. And it's just like, it's just a long period of time to ask for someone's attention. I say as somebody who watched 9 hours of Cheer in one day. But yes, I would agree with you that in general, when I see a movie runtime and it's like 90 to 100 minutes, I'm like, I'm excited. You know, I'm like,
wow. And it just means that there's a sense of purpose, I think, right? Like if you can edit well, oftentimes that means you know exactly what you're doing. So I think as a piece of like cinema, again, this movie is groovy. It's cool. It's like so compelling. It's so beautiful. Is it the most like compelling Shakespeare adaptation I've ever seen or Shakespeare performance I've ever seen? Probably not. Like, I think that if I have critiques about it, it's more in how it does or doesn't sort of bring the text to life. But the thing is, like, I can go see Macbeth anywhere, right? Like, I can go to a free Shakespeare in the Park and see it, or I'm sure watch a million performances on YouTube. So I don't think it needs to be the best Macbeth adaptation ever. It's sort of cool that it's just this weird half play, half movie thing that is sort of unlike anything I've seen before. So yeah, I really connected with this one.
Devendra, what'd you think?
Yeah, I also feel very groovy, baby, because it's this is such a beautiful film. Like it is. Yeah, we've seen so many Macbeth adaptations. We just saw one a couple of years ago, which was also like very visually stylish. But unlike that last one, was that Justin Kurzweil, I believe.
Yes, very good, Devendra. Yeah, and that was like, you know, Devendra, that was longer ago than we think. It was. Yeah. I actually rewatched part of it. It was 2014, I think, that movie came out.
I mean, 20 years ago, basically. Yeah. but I remember really wanting to be into that movie because I liked him as a director. I thought the visual aesthetic he was going for seemed really cool. Turns out that movie was pretty much all aesthetic and not really like biting into like the text or giving me interesting performances or anything. And then you have this, which is also like a very visually compelling production of Macbeth. But I think it looks incredible. It doesn't look like, you know, any like movie, you know, released in the last decade. Like, you know, we've seen a lot of like black and white stuff, and maybe it's a bit like The Lighthouse, which was also, I believe, 4:3 and also like very stark and black and white. But the aesthetic is very different because, it is very much play like. It is like they're not hiding the fact that this is on a stage, you know,
Let's talk briefly about the look of the movie. It is unlike anything you've seen before because this set of decisions, I think, is very rare. I don't even know if it's ever happened before, which is they shot it in what appears to be 4:3.
Mm-hmm.
It's not shot on film, I don't believe. It's shot on Arri Alexa large format, I think. So everything is razor sharp, right? So it's not like the lighthouse. The lighthouse looks like it was shot on film. And then it appears to be done in such a way where you as the viewer are acutely aware of the artifice of every of every shot. Like, it's very clear that these people are on a stage, basically, or on a set of some kind, right?
If they're in a forest, they're just like surrounded by a couple trees, and that's it.
Or like a painting of trees or whatever, you know. Like, so it's just like such a distinct set of decisions that I don't recall ever seeing ever, like, this set of decisions before to portray anything, let alone Macbeth.
Sure. And that definitely carried me along too. It's like, you know, it's Macbeth. I've read it, I've studied it, I've seen it performed many times. There are still certain sections where I'm like, I have very little idea of what's actually happening, but it was so compelling, and Denzel Washington is great. Frances McDormand is great. And certainly, Catherine Hunter as the witches, just like, holy shit.
Amazing. Like, unlike anything I've ever seen. Like, this version of Macbeth absolutely nails the witches, right? Like, this is just like such a distinct presentation of the witches. I've never seen anything like it before. So
absolutely. Like, basically every time Catherine Hunter appears is a nightmare. And now something I can't stop thinking about.
Yes.
But yeah, so overall, really, really dug this one.
I'll share a few thoughts. I mean, I overall really loved it as well. I think this movie is such a gift because it's like, oh, to be able to see Denzel, one of the greatest actors of our generation, play Macbeth, that's just amazing. It's not lovely to see it. Frances McDormand, you know, doing her thing as well. It's amazing. It's just like, wow, I can't believe we got to see it. You know, I love that this movie exists. Huge fan of it. Devinger, you've already pointed out why it's beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about some of the decisions that this Macbeth makes that are kind of interesting, right? In addition to the visuals that make you acutely aware of the fact that you're watching a stage play, right? It manages to fuse film and stage play in a way that nothing else I've ever seen does. But the biggest decision I think this movie makes is in the casting of Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand. Typically, I think Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are much younger, right? Like, I imagine them in their 30s.
Like, an ambitious, the time where you would expect somebody to be like very ambitious and kind of an up and comer.
Also during a time in human history when if you were a general of an army, you might not live past your 30s, right?
Right.
And your life expectancy was not necessarily that high past your 30s. And so, yes. But you're right too, like the time when the ambition might be there. And so by casting these older actors who are in their 60s, it really does give all the proceedings a very different feel to it. This idea that Macbeth doesn't have any heirs, which is a plot point in the play, now takes on a more special resonance. And the idea that, like, maybe this is the way to secure their legacy, you know, by murdering the king and taking his place, you know, like, that's all given just a very different feel now in this version of the movie. I believe only one change was made to the actual text of Shakespeare, which is the line about, like, you know, you're not, like, you should have boys or something like that. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
There's this line when he says to her, like, you know, you're such a badass, like, you should be having, you should only have boys, like, if you have children, right? And like, I think it was changed to like the past tense, if I recall correctly. It's just kind of interesting, like, that's like one of the choices they make. One of the other big choices they make is the decision to make Ross like a fairly central character. Ross is played by Alex Hassel, and he's like almost like a lead in this film.
Guy with the face of, like, whatever he plays, you think he's a vampire. Like, he just has a very, very distinctive face. He was vicious in Cowboy Bebop too, and he had like no presence in that show, whereas here he's just like, what is this vampire up to, you know? Yeah,
it's funny you point out the face. To me, it was all about the costume, which is like this incredible, beautiful, like, it's like a robe, but it's like cinched in almost like a column dress. Like, I was like, how is he walking in it? This has, like, it is so tight,
two flowing like tails almost. So it looks like he's about to fly at all times.
And basically, the line I was talking about earlier, I just want to clarify, is like the line about, like, they changed one of the verses that Denzel's character says into the past tense, basically. The line was, bring forth men children only, for thy undaunted metal should produce nothing but males. That's the line. And they changed it to should have produced. I think that's the only tweak they made to the language in the whole play. So, but yes, going back to Ross, what's interesting about the Ross character is that in the original version of the play, Macbeth hires these two guys to go and kill, I think it's, is it Macduff or the other guy, right? Banquo. The two assassins are met by a third unnamed dude in the original play, but in the movie they make it Ross. That character is Ross, which is like, oh, what a like kind of clever way to kind of make this character more resonant. And then of course the movie ends with Ross as well. You find out that Ross actually did not murder Fleance, but that he's actually like saved Fleance's life and like is like keeping Fleance for his own ends, you know, essentially.
Very much like one of those Game of Thrones characters, you know, who's just like always trying mm-hmm. to serve the kingdom.
Yeah, it's like a Varys, very Varys or Littlefinger-esque character that Ross becomes.
That has existed in other Shakespeare plays too. Like people who basically have no motives that the greater plot has, right? They are just this force of nature that kind of exists out there.
But I just, it's just always cool. You know, whenever you see a filmed adaptation, it's always just interesting to see what decisions they made. What did they leave in? What did they leave out? Right. And in this case, how did they actually like transform like one of the characters to make him like way more prominent in this version? So that's totally fascinating. Overall, I loved just kind of observing that, watching the film. I think all the actors did a great job. Here's the biggest weakness of this movie, in my opinion, is it goes too fast. This is one of the most movies. It's an hour and 50 minutes long. I'm like, this should have been 20 minutes longer.
You want more. Yeah.
Not even more. They could have made this 20 minutes longer and not changed any of the dialogue.
Right, in this
movie. But it is just going from scene to scene to mm-hmm. scene to scene to scene. Like it's moving.
Give it time
quickly
to breathe. It would be nice.
Right, yeah. It's just like you theoretically, like, I don't know what the time frame of the Macbeth is, like the play Macbeth is. I think it's years, right? It's years that happen between act one and the final act. And it all happens. It feels like it could have happened in an afternoon in this version, right? And you don't like the performance is there. Like Denzel is doing a great job, but you really need to kind of feel time more in a way that I don't think this play version allows you to do. And it's very different than like the Justin Kurzel version. So I actually went back and watched the Justin Kurzel version. And that, Caroline, have you seen the Justin Kurzel, the Michael Fassbender?
No, it's a blind spot for me.
It is a beautiful prequel to Assassin's Creed, basically, right?
Yeah.
With the same actors, yeah.
It is a beautiful film. And there's like really striking visuals in it. And like, as an example of like, here's a great example of like, how it's different is there is a scene in this movie when like towards the beginning when like Macbeth is being presented with like the Thane of Caldor sash or whatever it is. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, I think in the tragedy of Macbeth movie, like they go outside and they kill the Thane of Caldor, like right there. Like, mm-hmm. it's just like, mm-hmm. yep, by the way, like he's dead now. We're killing him, you know,
as if it was like blocked for a stage play, basically. Right.
Right.
Like,
right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And in the Kurzel version, what happens is, Macbeth has just been in battle. He is literally holding like one of his soldiers who's like in an agonizing pain as he's being like repaired or, you know, treated medically. And then somebody comes like into the middle of the battlefield and like presents him like, hey, by the BT dubs, like you're Thane of Caldor now. Like, and you know, he's like Michael Fassbender's character is like in the middle of like other shit, you know, like he's doing mm-hmm. other stuff. And you get the sense that like, you know, the purpose of that version was to transplant the language of Macbeth into like a very gritty, realistic sort of period piece. And that's not what the objective of this one is. This is to kind of put on a kind of hybrid stage filmed version of it. And I do think that the pacing suffers because of that. Caroline, what do you think of the pacing of this one? Am I way off base? What do you think?
No, I sort of understand what you're saying, but I almost wouldn't put it down to the pacing. I would put it down to, like, I think that there's a way to present Shakespearean language that is a little clearer than the way that this movie does, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Like there's, I think that this movie really prioritizes sort of a naturalism to the way the dialogue comes out.
Right.
And it's a very, they're very sort of like small and internal performances. But I think because of that, there can sometimes be a slightly like monotone quality to it, where it feels less like the actor is sort of guiding you through what they're saying and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, like you'll see some Shakespeare productions and they'll do a hand gesture that is really clarifying of something or something that's a little more heightened that is really guiding the audience through the language. And I think maybe because this movie isn't doing that and because it has that slightly more monotone quality, it's almost easier to like zone out or feel like you're a step behind. And then I think because of that, things feel like they're moving quicker. I mean, maybe what I'm talking about is just something completely different than what you're talking about. But that
I think
was
that's
at
a
least...
great point. But here's what I'm going to put out. What I'm going to point out is one of our biggest complaints with the Justin Kurzel Macbeth is that it took what you're saying to an extreme.
Yeah.
Like, people, like, I went back and watched, because remember, Devinder, when we talked about that movie, I guess 7 years ago now, we were complaining about how poorly that movie treated the Shakespearean language.
I remember Jeff was really hurt by that.
And I was too. I was like, I was not happy with it because you have people basically like whisper talking the lines, right? They're speaking it ultra naturalistically. Like they're speaking it like they would movie dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it sucks. Like I that's by far the biggest weakness of that version of Macbeth is it does not honor the language, in my opinion. And I would say this one does a much better job, but it is still relatively naturalistic. So I guess what I'm saying to you is I agree with you, but also it could have been way worse than what it is.
Sure.
In this movie.
Absolutely.
And if you watch the Kurzel version, it's like the way the witches, you know, they literally speak like, you know, all hail Macbeth, Thane of Caldor. You know, like mm-hmm. they literally talk like that. And
that's the thing about Shakespeare. Like I totally get why just the idea of Shakespeare is so off-putting for people, because I think if it's not done well, it just can be off-putting. I think when you're just reading it, it can be really off-putting. Like it's kind of a shame that most people's introduction is in just like reading it in a high school class, because it's just not meant to be read. It's meant to be seen. And I think the tragedy of Macbeth mostly does a really good job with that, even if I don't know if I would put it up there with like my all-time favorite like version of people sort of bringing Shakespeare to life, at least in the dialogue.
Do you have a favorite version? I'm curious, that comes to mind.
You know, Macbeth is actually one of the Shakespeares I'm not super familiar with in terms of like just other performers that I think are great at Shakespeare. I think that David Tennant, who most people probably know first and foremost from Doctor Who, is like maybe the greatest living Shakespearean actor. I think he is, like, if you want to hear what it sounds like to bring the dialogue to life in a way that sounds completely naturalistic, but also is highlighting the poetry of it. Mm-hmm. He has filmed production. They were stage productions, but filmed versions of Hamlet. This like really great Much Ado About Nothing with Catherine Tate. And then he did this production of Richard II that if you can track down, like I would so highly recommend. I think it's one of the best Shakespeare performances I've ever seen. But yeah, I think you see somebody like David Tennant do it, which is not to say that the actors in Tragedy of Macbeth are not also great, but I think he is such a top tier example of how to blend the naturalism with the heightenedness and sort of get them both. And once you see that, you're like, oh, this is how it's sort of all supposed to sound. And it makes so much more sense when you hear someone like that do it.
Great references. I'm curious if there's any like filmed versions you're a fan of. Like, did you like Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, for instance?
You know what? That's also a blind spot for me. I do like Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado. I think that that's another one that probably leans slightly more on the heightened side, but is just like super enjoyable and fun. I think ultimately, like, this is probably my theater route showing, but like, I do tend to prefer Shakespeare on stage to mm-hmm. Shakespeare mm-hmm. filmed. And again, I think that maybe is something that I liked so much about Tragedy of Macbeth is that it did embrace the sort of inherent staginess of it.
Yeah.
And didn't try to make it fully natural, particularly in the visuals. So I would say that this is like honestly, if Joel Cohen just wants to just go ahead and do every Shakespeare play like this for the next, you know, every couple of years, just like put one out, I would happily watch as many of these as he wants to put out.
I literally had that new thought.
Is it a new like format, like the screen view format, like coming through your computer screens or something like
that. Fathom events or something like that. Yeah. I literally had that thought of like, man, it would be great if you could just go through the entire catalog and just like do it in this way. That would be awesome.
And do them all under 2 hours.
It'd be nice.
Well, that's the other thing is the full play of Macbeth, I think, takes roughly 2.5 hours to do. So they obviously edited out a bunch of stuff. And I got to say, I think they did a pretty good job of the edit. Like what I mean by that is they left in a bunch of the stuff that is the most easily comprehensible, you know, because there's a bunch of stuff that's like hard to understand. It's hard to grok. And I think most of the stuff they left in is like pretty clear and obvious. Not all of it. Some of it still is kind of obscure and you need to like read or think about it. But yeah, I think they did a good job with the edit. I do think it went a little bit fast. One of the distinct parts about this movie is that it actually has some of that good old Coen brothers ultra violence in it.
Yeah, it does.
When I watch like a Shakespeare adaptation, I don't recall seeing the violence enough like attention or that much attention given to it, nor is it this graphic usually, I feel like. Especially for Caroline, if you're talking about like a film version of a play, they do it very like stylistically, right? The violence.
Yeah, I'm trying to
remember. Somebody takes out a red handkerchief or something like that.
Kurosawa's Throne of Blood is certainly a very like violent and wild, you know, interpretation of this. Yeah.
Yes, totally.
I was trying to remember how violent the Polanski version is, which I have not seen since high school, but I think that one might really lean into the sort of bloody battleness of it all. But this one is like visceral in a different way because it's not big epic battles. It's a lot more like really small, intimate, like hand-to-hand scenes, which I think almost can feel more visceral sometimes.
Absolutely. I thought it was very effective. And the scene when Macbeth murders Duncan is just really brutal in a way that I didn't I expected it to happen off screen because I don't think it happens explicitly in the play. Like it happens in the play, but I don't think it happens like quote unquote on screen in the play. Like I just recall Macbeth talking about like, hey, I did the deed. And also, by the way, I brought the knives back for some reason. Like that's what happens in the play. But like, I don't think it's necessarily in the instructions to show it happening. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, so the fact that they showed it and like when, you know, Duncan wakes up and the look on Denzel's face is just like chilling, man. It's chilling.
That's why you show it, right? It's just for like that sort of like little visual poetry there. Once I heard Denzel was playing Macbeth, I just like, I really wanted to see him do some cool sword shit. And this movie certainly delivered at the very end. So yeah. Worth a watch just for that one scene where he's basically taking on who that character is, but basically taking on the
is
guy
it Malcolm that he's fighting at the end there.
It could be yeah it could be or no Malcolm is the
he's fighting you're right. I apologize
but I forget the character, but it's just like it is a fight where he's like, I am fucking untouchable. I have been ordained to be immortal, so I'm going to fight you as if you cannot hurt me. And just that like brazen way he approaches that fight and like he gets a scar in his face and just like is like slapping this guy around who has a full length sword on him while Macbeth is unarmed, throws the sword back at the guy. It's just so that is
badass.
Like it's totally badass. And it's also like action that is telling you so much about the character. And that is my favorite type of action. Like that's his headspace. He is fully bought into the prophecy and he thinks he's untouchable. Yeah.
Yeah.
What great, I love is sequence. Just the way he sits on that throne.
So good.
Which I think if you are a male Shakespearean actor, maybe women too, but like the most important quality you can have is just like to sit on a throne in a compelling way.
You gotta own the throne. Yeah.
You have to own the throne and just the like, this is like casual arrogance of how he's sitting, like the sense of entitlement, even as his life is like in some ways collapsing. Mm-hmm. But he does have that sense of like, well, no man born of woman can kill me. So like, I'm just going to sit here and do my thing. And it's so compelling. Like just the shot of him sitting is so compelling. Okay.
Take thy face hence. Just, oh, please. So good.
Also the scene when he fights Corey Hawkins' character, Macduff, at the end, right? And I did not expect the beheading to actually happen. You know?
Yeah, Sam.
He gets beheaded and then the crown like flies off into the distance and it's kind of this beautiful sort of metaphor for what's going on there.
The way it's staged too, I actually didn't notice this fully or didn't like register it until a second viewing, but it's like the battle sort of evenly matched. What screws him over is his crown falls off his head And sort of in the middle of battle, he goes to put it back on, like another moment of this like arrogance of like, well, I'm the king, I should put this on. And that's when he gets beheaded, which I think is another great little detail.
Also love it's staged in a very like claustrophobic setting too. So they're like, they're very much like just going back and forth there too. That's just, man, Corey Hawkins is also very good in this movie.
Yeah, he's very good in this
movie.
I mean, I gotta say, there are some parts of Macbeth that are kind of hilarious, okay? And I'm gonna identify them. One of them is like this whole like riddle that the witches give, like, "Hey, like, you know, you're gonna be king until this other forest goes to this forest, you know, like." And he's like, "Well, that's never gonna happen. That's impossible." And he's like, "And don't worry, you're not gonna be killed by somebody that was of woman born." And he's like, "Well, that's basically everyone, you know."
That's
and
it's basically like, everyone.
It's kind of like this monkey's paw-esque, like. And by BT Dubs, like both of those things happen. It's a dark play, but also I find that stuff pretty hilarious.
It's hilarious. It is a great little twist too. Like I remember reading it in high school and thinking, "That is like that is the coolest twist ever." Right? It is ingenious. Actually,
use the original M. Night Shyamalan.
Exactly. Exactly.
Shakespeare was. And then there is also this scene where Ross goes to Macduff and he's like, "Yes, like your wife and kid were fine when I last saw them."
Totally fine. Wink, wink. Yeah.
A lot of my wife was saying there's a doctor in Arrested Development who like would give like stuff that was only technically correct. Mm-hmm. He's like, your son is going to be all right. And he's like, "Oh, thank God." And it's like, "I mean, he lost his left arm, so he's going to be all right." You know, and it's like, it's kind of that. He's like, they were breathing fine when I last saw them.
That whole scene is hilarious. A minute later, he's like, "Yeah, they're all dead. Yeah, all of them." "Kids too?" "Yeah, the kids, all of them. All of them all dead." And he took like no breath between the lie and the reality.
This could have come to my attention 30 seconds ago, you know, when you were telling me they were fine.
Lead with that.
Lead with the bad news, maybe.
I think you're not wrong that there is something sort of ridiculous about Macbeth. Like, it's just the plot kicks off because the guy's just like walking home from work and some witches are like, "Hey, you're going to be king." And he's like, "Oh, cool. I should kill everyone I know right now." Like, immediately, that's what I should do. I kind of like Macbeth goes hard. This is, it just like jumps right in. The way I was always taught about like the origin of this play was basically just that King James of Scotland had newly become King James of England and just like liked mystical witch shit, and so Shakespeare was like, "Cool, I'll just write a Scottish mystical witch play for you to like please you." And I feel like you can kind of feel that coming through, but in kind of a fun way, like, yeah, just a story of some witches just like making this guy ruin his own life for really no reason.
They don't threaten him, you know what I mean? They don't say you must do this or else we'll kill someone, you know. They're just like, "Hey, BT Dubs, here's some stuff that's gonna happen."
Right.
I'm murdering my best friend, the king.
The king is like, "Write me some witch fic, you know?"
Yeah.
And Shakespeare's like, "Sure, sure." And the king is like, "Witches do be like that." Yes.
Yeah.
They do mess around with our lives for no reason. Yes.
Yes, yes. This is the ultimate fuck around and find out story. But it is kind of, it actually kind of reminds me of sort of modern day time travel movies where like the time machine becomes like a monster or basically like the future prophecy that needs to be fulfilled ends up being some kind of like monstrous trap. The best example I can think of right now is like Time Crimes, you know, where like this guy is like needing to like really harm people and himself in order to fulfill what he believes needs to happen. You know, this is kind of one of the original, the OG version of that, you know, the OG Time Crimes is like, they tell him the future and he's like, "Well, I got to do it now. I got to do it now." I want to point out as we wrap up here, a couple of the sort of decisions that this movie makes regarding some big classic monologues, right? So one of the classic monologues that I referenced in my opening of the podcast is "This a dagger I see before me? Come, let me clutch thee," right? And the idea behind that scene is that he is seeing an actual dagger in front of him. And he's like imagining a dagger, right? And I thought that was interesting that basically what we discover in this movie is that they made the door handles like daggers.
Right? as he's walking down the world's longest hallway.
Longest hallways ever.
The like runway from Fast and Furious as a hallway. He's just going, forever on that.
From Fast and Furious 6, right? Yeah. And I was just like, oh, that's kind of a clever way to do that. Is like make the door handle like the it's a little bit literal, but it's also that's cool.
That was something where I was like, okay, Joel Cohen. Okay, I get it. I see what you're doing. You're having fun here. And then there's a scene like the double toil and trouble scene, which is just like, holy shit.
When they made he's like sitting in like a pool of soup, basically. Yes. Yeah, that was like,
it's just like, oh, so man. Cool. That is a pure horror movie sequence too. And he picks up the head and is just talking to it. Like, it is such a both a imaginative and really playful interpretation of that scene, which we have seen time and time again. You know, like, that is cliche at this point. But no, there's no cauldron. It's just like, it's what you imagine. Sure.
Yeah. Also, the out damn spot was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought Frances McDormand's performance was really excellent there. She's clearly like deteriorating. And the idea is that she has stains on her shirt, right? Like in the play, when I read that scene, I always imagined she'd have like stains on her shirt,
or her hands. That was me, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but whatever the case, it was like water. Like in the movie, it was just water that she had, which I was just like, huh, kind of interesting. What did you make of that, Caroline? Did you appreciate some of these kind of like interesting choices, or were there any other decisions that you felt like were really bang on?
Well, in general, I do really like the way they sort of interpreted the magical elements of the movie, which I think, like you're saying, with the dagger and even with the out damn spot they are like literal. Like, there's both the literal explanation and the sort of magical explanation, and the movie will sort of let you, you know, you can choose which one you want to believe. But like the Banquo's ghost sequence, like they do something where like sometimes we're seeing the ghost, sometimes we're seeing nothing, and sometimes we're seeing this crow, which is also a symbol of the witches, and you're sort of left to wonder which one of these things, you know, what's actually going on there. But I think the magic in general, and like, again, we cannot overstate the witches in particular in Catherine Hunter's performance, like this fascinating like contortionist and like crow inspired performance. She's one person, but sometimes she's three people. Like
that,
you hate everything else about this movie, you should watch it for the witches alone, because they're just so compellingly done.
It is one of the most vivid interpretations of the witches. I mean, just the first scene when she shows up and then there's like two witches in the reflection of the water. It's like, this is incredible. And by the way, you know, if you ever go back to revisit the Kurtzel version, Caroline, the witches are really lame in that version. And so comparatively, it's like they are one of the most prominent characters in the play. And the fact that this movie nails the witches in a really effective way is a huge triumph. So, overall, a lot of things to appreciate about this version. There are some weaknesses, I think, in the pacing, I think in some of the delivery that, Caroline, you've alluded to. Anything else we want to say about this? Or shall we wrap it up?
I mean, it's just fun to watch Denzel do Shakespeare. I know he's done a lot of it on stage, and he's done less of it on screen. He was in the Branagh Much Ado, and he's wonderful, not a huge role, but it is just so like such a joy and a gift to watch him as a Macbeth, even if it's maybe a more reserved Macbeth than I've seen before. Like, the sort of monotone quality I was talking about, as much as I think occasionally it's a hindrance, it also leads to such cool moments, because he's slightly more low key. The moments where he does go big are so effective, and then the moments when he can rein it in and be really small can be equally effective. And yeah, I'm just so glad that this performance is like captured forever.
On that note, by the way, we should point out that yes, Denzel Washington is in the lead, and also this is a very diverse cast, and there is a large diversity of accents as well. Like, they allowed Denzel and Frances McDormand to like use American accents, and Brendan Gleeson has his Irish accent, and Harry Melling and Alex Hassel use English accents. And so there is this kind of, first of all, I'm very glad they did this. I'm very glad they didn't force Denzel to do a Scottish accent, but there's this kind of like, it kind of gives it this, people can debate how effective that is for them. Like, but for me, I think there is this idea of like, what they're going for is it makes the play more universal. Like, this is anyone could be in any of these roles, you know, is a feeling I get from it, right? Is that like people from all around the world, people of all different sizes and shapes and colors, they're all in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it's just like makes for a very interesting sort of version of the play that one could argue is more universal, potentially more relatable for larger groups of people. So that is another very deliberate decision that they made to make this movie. So.
You know, I saw this movie a couple days after I saw the finale of Station 11, which also features the Shakespeare adaptation of Hamlet too. And it's very much like, it's interesting. It's interesting that like at the end of the world, this is what people hold on to. But at the same time, like I'm thinking of like, we keep coming back to this. You know, there is a universality. There is like almost an immortality to Shakespeare's works. It speaks to the human condition and something we can always relate to. So yeah, doing it without the accents, doing it in a way that's a little more, I wouldn't say modernized, but certainly like adapted to where we are right now, technologically, so many different things, right? Like this is something people are streaming on their TVs, you know, it was captured on high-end digital cameras. So much of it feels so new and fresh. And I feel like that's a big part of like what makes Shakespeare work, but it's still a good story at the end of the day, right? Like no matter what you add to it, it's still a good story.
Still a good story. And the language is still incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are lines in this movie that they have lived for hundreds of years, and there's a reason for that. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. You know, lines like that just like speak so much to how people feel, to existentialism and things like that, that just like there's a reason this language has stood the test of time. And I think that the tragedy of Macbeth is a lovely rendition of it, a beautiful tribute to this this play, and ultimately I think very effective. So I'm a big fan. Sounds like you all were as well. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's really impressive that Joel Cohen made a movie, especially like the play, the sort of movie had to be shut down due to COVID. So they had to shut down, took a few weeks off, and then they came back. And I was reading about the making of this, and like when they came back, they were still, they didn't even know that much about COVID at the time. Like they still thought it could be transmitted by touch, you know, during when they were filming this. So it's just like, you can imagine how difficult it was to make during that time period. But I'm really glad they got it done. So that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the Filmcast. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McEwen, whose newest project is Varsity Blue. You can check him out right now at The Midnight. Our weekly plugs bumper comes from Noah Ross. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker and YouTuber Kyle Corwith. This episode was edited by Beatty Zhang. I want to thank Caroline Sita again for joining us today. Be sure to check out Caroline's podcast, Roll Calling, R-O-L-E calling. Caroline, thanks a lot for stepping in and showing your theater kid roots for our review of The Tragedy of Macbeth. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. It's always a blast to be here.
Okay, so the next few weeks are weird, guys. I'm going to put that out there. There is not much going on in the theaters until February 4th, I think, which is when Jackass Forever comes out. And
what everyone's waiting for, right before my birthday, Jackass Forever. Yes.
Yeah. Nice reference to the birthday slipped in there, Devendra. But yeah, it's like, even if we did review Jackass Forever, which I'm not sure we will, it's like not necessarily a movie you can have a deep conversation about. You know,
that would be the ultimate like Jackass stunt, though. Like the guys brave a pandemic to review Jackass Forever.
So we're kind of in the middle of debating what exactly we should watch for next week. But our current plan is to review Station 11. On next week's episode of the podcast. So I do think it is a really ambitious work that deserves a lot of conversation. Mm-hmm. And so we hope you will join us in catching up to Station 11. You can stream all 10 episodes now on HBO Max. And we are going to plan to discuss it in depth as our main review on next week's episode of the podcast. There are other things that like might come out on video on demand in the near future that may compete for our attention, you know? And we will debate them in turn and kind of figure it out. But it's just a weird time right now. We're not really going into theaters. And also, even if we were, there's not much coming out in theaters right now.
I really want to talk about Scream, but that'll be a VOD.
Oh, yes. Definitely. No, we will talk about Scream, you know, but it's just, probably, you know, whenever it comes out on video demand, which is probably going to be in like 5 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. But there's also very likelihood going to be a Scream retrospective, probably as an After Dark. So that's something we're planning on as well. But just like, we just don't know enough information about when Scream is going to be on video on demand yet. And so we can't plan around it. So we appreciate your patience. But yes, next week, conversation about Station 11. Look forward to that on the Filmcast. Until then, thanks for listening. We'll see you later.